WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven and the Wyand Cimbali Group.
Mark Bittman is a nationally known best-selling author on cooking. His book, How to Cook Everything, has really become the Bible of simple cooking. I assume a lot of you have it in your home and have used it. My mom actually gave me my book, and she's a wonderful, fabulous cook, and she's British, believe it or not. But I love the book. I love it. So Mark has actually cooked with some of the best-known chefs in the world. He is a journalist, a television personality, and more importantly to me, he's really a respected spokesperson about the ecological and health impacts of our modern diet, which I just find fascinating. He's just really always giving us updated information on what's going on in the world. So without further ado, I am going to introduce the wonderful Mark Bittman.
How do we start? Normally, I have 15 or 20 minutes to sort of gather my feeble thoughts before a talk, but as you saw, I was signing books, which is great. So I have no formal relationship with IKEA, just to make that clear, but obviously, like everybody else, I wind up shopping here. It's sort of inevitable, I think, the way things are, but having made my disclaimers, they have really supported WSHU in this effort. IKEA bought the books that you then in turn bought, so SHU is really benefiting mightily from this, so I think they do, yeah. I mean, that doesn't happen often, so that's a very cool thing. I thought I might, New Haven is a very special place to me. I lived here 25 years or maybe even a little longer, and I thought I might start by reminiscing a bit because I think my experience here was in a way representative of what's happened in food in the last 30 or 40 years. And maybe some of you will enjoy this. And then I'll talk a little bit about the three or four things that I think are most important to think about in food right now. And then I'll save a lot of time for questions because they usually wind up being fun. I moved here in 78. January 78, right after the great blizzard and right after the birth of my first daughter. I was already a cook, I was already a writer, but I hadn't yet written anything about food. I wrote my first piece about food for the New Haven Advocate February 28th or March 1st, I can never remember which, 1980. So we're well over 30 years of doing this at this point. At that time, I lived on Brownell Street just off of Whaley Avenue, right near Boulevard. And the neighborhood was mixed and quite amazing. Peg Nataro's, which is now a Walgreens, like every other minor supermarket in the United States. Peg Nataro's stocked food for Italian people, black people, and Jewish people. And anyone else, but I mean, you would see sort of pig's feet next to chicken fat. But you would. People remember this, right? Paramount, a fruit and vegetable store, was down the block. There were two kosher bakeries and a kosher butcher on Whaley Avenue. There was, after not too long a time, the New Haven Food Co-op on the site of the old Whaley Cinema. Edge of the Woods was on Edgewood Avenue. Edge of the Woods, by the way, is practically a national treasure as far as I'm concerned. There were farms in Woodbridge and Bethany. For that matter, there were farms in Westport. A lot's changed, obviously. I think that as I cooked and as I started writing about food, I really treasured what was here. There were three or four fishmongers, mostly in the Hill neighborhood or in the, near the hospital, who were taking advantage of the fact that there still was a very active and quite productive northeastern fishery. I could talk about that for a long time. I won't. But through the 80s and well into the 90s, it became one by one, every one of those institutions, except for Edge of the Woods, every one of those institutions went away. And all of my shopping, or 90% of my shopping, and I'm sure 90% of your shopping was and is done at Stop and Shop. Not that I have anything against Stop and Shop, but it does not quite replace the vibrancy that our neighborhoods, not only in New Haven, but elsewhere, once had. Nor does it particularly rely on local food, which was something that we had, if not an abundance of, a fair share of here 30 years ago. What we've also seen, and this is national, if not international, what we've also seen is sort of an increase in the number of products in our supermarkets, but a decrease in the quality of those products, a decrease in reliance on local, or I'd rather say regional food, so food from, say, the northeastern United States. And as I cooked and as I became more knowledgeable, I guess, about food and about writing about food, I found myself seeking out farmers in Wallingford, a store in Norwalk, the sort of last remaining vestiges of where can I go for real food. And there came a point, and this was sort of in the 90s, when I realized that shopping in supermarkets was not really doing it for me, and yet there were no longer any remaining choices. So what happened through the 90s and into the 2000s is that I recognized that much as I wanted to cook really good, simple ingredients for myself and my family and my friends, it was becoming increasingly difficult to find the really good, simple ingredients. And as I said, that was a national phenomenon. That was not a New Haven problem. It's a national problem. I started to think about these things. I started to look at what's now known as the obesity crisis. I started to look at what was in our food, how it was produced, and so on. And in 2000 or so, I decided to write How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, not because I wanted to embrace my inner vegetarian, because there is no inner vegetarian, but because I thought I saw the writing on the wall. And the writing on the wall is this: we're going to be eating an increasingly plant-based diet, and we're going to be eating, we already are eating, less and less factory-farmed meat, or industrially produced meat, however you want to call it. So as that, I wrote How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, I started to think more seriously about those kinds of things. I started to write more pieces for the Times about food as opposed to about cooking. Not that I stopped writing about cooking, but I started to write about food and eating and agriculture and the environment and so on. And some of you, I'm sure, follow this stuff. I started to eat a unusual diet of being very strictly vegan all day long and then doing whatever I want at dinner time. And that's a whole other story. But I started calling that vegan before six, which was I know everybody gets sort of a laugh out of that, but it was a pretty good title, actually, for something that introduces a degree of flexibility into an otherwise strict diet. And actually, my next book is called Vegan Before Six and coming out next month. And 2 years ago, two-plus years ago, I went to the editors at the Times and I said, food is as important as economics, and I may not be Paul Krugman. I'm not Paul Krugman, in fact. I may not be in the same league as Paul Krugman, but you should have a food op-ed guy, and that food op-ed guy should be me. And the irony of that is that, especially here in New Haven, the irony of that is that that is the second time I had the arrogance to walk into an editor's office and say, you need a guy to do this, and that guy is me. And the first time was in 1980 at the New Haven Advocate. So both times it worked out really well. And I've been writing about food and eating, the environment and agriculture and so on for 2+ years at the Times now, in addition to doing what I hope is still pretty good work as a cookbook author. So that's all by way of introduction, I suppose, to talk about the four things that I think are most important in food today. And I've given this a lot of thought because I give a lot of talks, and some of you may have seen a talk I did at TED about 5 years ago when I first started getting into this. And in a way, very little has changed since that talk. We can all analyze what went wrong with food in the United States, what is wrong with food in the United States. But whenever I give a talk, people would say, well, what should we do? So I had the opportunity to be confronted with that question weekly, at least, and finally forced myself to say, okay, I'm going to integrate the what should we do questions into my talks, because people do want to take action. So what should we do? One thing we need to do is for ourselves and as a society is define what food is. Because only by defining what food is can we say, this is what we ought to be eating. And the irony is, we don't have a formal definition of food. The dictionary does. The dictionary says food is something that living beings, including plants, but animals and people, living beings take in order to enhance growth and health, to promote growth, not this kind of growth, but this kind of growth, and health. So that's the definition of food. Well, if you look at that definition of food, you can easily arrive at a definition of non-food. Non-food doesn't promote health. Well, there are plenty of things sold in supermarkets today and elsewhere that don't, in fact, promote health. They promote ILF, as a friend of mine calls it. And we know what those foods are. Chief among those, and something I've written extensively about, is soda, which from which Americans get 7% of their calories, more than from any other single food. And the beverage industry would have us believe that we get only 7% of our calories from soda. But soda is a non-food that does not promote health. And by defining food, we can define non-food. And then when people say, well, you can't regulate food, food is stuff people eat what they want, we can say, yeah, but we can regulate non-food. That's number one. Number two is transparency. And I'll talk about transparency by talking about GMOs, which actually are not something that I feel extremely strongly about, but many people do. 90% of the people in the United States have said that they want to see foods labeled, foods that contain GMOs labeled as such. And of course, in Europe, foods that contain GMOs are labeled, and no one buys them. So there's a, it's true, there's a strong resistance to labeling foods with GMOs by the industry because it'd be a big hassle for them. Not that people would stop buying their products, because what they would do would just be to formulate them without foods containing GMOs. But so there's a struggle about this. And the fact is that GMOs have not really been proven to be bad for your health. If you eat cornflakes made from corn that's grown from genetically engineered seeds, they're not worse for you than cornflakes are in the first place. Really, the point is that cornflakes are not very good for you in the first place. So there was a vote in California this past fall where advocates were trying to get GMOs labeled in California. And as you know, as California goes, so goes the nation. So if that had passed in California, it would have soon become if not the law, then the de facto law in the rest of the country. And it was defeated largely because the opponents outspent the advocates by something like 40-1 and spent, I think $1 million per percentage point that they gained during the course of the campaign. I may not have that right, but it was something like that. The point really isn't about GMOs. The point is we need to know what's in our food and how our food is produced. By knowing what's in our food and how our food is produced, we can make another judgment. Not only what is food, what is the food that we want to eat? So if you say, I don't want to eat GMOs, you're right as far as I'm concerned. That's one thing. If you say, I don't want to eat food that's tainted with antibiotics and that promotes bugs that are resistant to antibiotics and are making antibiotics less effective in, when used in treating disease in humans, that's another thing. If you say, I don't want to eat food that's got a huge amount of pesticides in them, that's another thing. I mean, we know we can eat organic food and theoretically avoid pesticides. Why can't we eat conventional food and eat maybe fewer pesticides or no pesticides? If you say, I want to eat food that comes from animals that haven't been tortured during the course of their life, that might be another thing you want to know. If you say, I want to eat food that's produced by people who are paid above the minimum wage and get health care benefits, that's another thing you might want to know. All of these things are things we have a right to know and things that the food industry would just as soon we didn't know. So transparency, I think, is a very important thing. And just to be maybe a little bit more concrete about it, if you saw a chicken with a label that said, contains antibiotic residues, may contain antibiotic-resistant E. coli, you might be less likely to buy that chicken. But that's 50% of the chicken that's sold in supermarkets. That's the case with them. If the same chicken said this chicken was processed in a plant where people are developing carpal tunnel syndrome from working way too fast and are earning the minimum wage or perhaps a little bit less and are working so few hours that the employer is not required to give them health insurance, that might be another thing that steered you away. I'm not saying we can expect this kind of labeling in this kind of detail. I'm saying we should be demanding this kind of labeling in this kind of detail. The third thing is regulation. And those of you who've read my columns, my opinion columns in the Times, know that I'm in favor of a soda tax. Not so much because I think it would be a panacea, but because I think it would be a very interesting experiment, because we'd probably see a decline in the amount of, if the tax was steep enough, we'd see a decline in the amount of soda being drunk. And 5 years later, we'd probably see improving public health numbers. Public health, we do regulate for public health. We have always regulated for public health. Probably the best example of that, the tobacco laws everybody knows about, but probably the best invisible example of that, especially for young people who grew up with them, are seatbelts. Seatbelts were started in Australia, and the Australians found, lo and behold, that using seatbelts saved lives. So a bunch of advocates in the United States started demanding that the big three automakers, now the big two or maybe the medium two automakers, put seatbelts in their cars. And of course, the big three resisted, saying that it was too expensive and would raise the cost of cars too much. We saw the same battle over airbags. Seatbelts, as it turns out, are more effective than airbags in saving lives. So ultimately, the federal government required the big three to put seatbelts in every new car that was manufactured. Big deal. What happened? Actually, not much. Why didn't that happen? Because the federal government required the automakers to put seatbelts in cars, but there was only some sort of vague educational campaign that seatbelts could save lives, and there was no requirement that seatbelts be used. And then one by one, every single state in the United States, all 50, enacted a seatbelt law that said click it or ticket or whatever. And as a result, tens of thousands of lives are saved every year by people wearing seatbelts. This is an example of a public health measure that was originally not popular because everybody said, I can make up my own mind whether I wear my seatbelts or not, but in fact have now saved the lives of people both willing and unwilling, originally unwilling, to use seatbelts. The same thing can happen in the food world. We are facing an obesity-related, and calling it an obesity-related is simplifying things a bit, but I don't have time to go into a huge amount of detail here. But we are facing a healthcare bill that's upwards of $200 billion a year from chronic diseases brought about by obesity and things related to obesity. We can cut that bill in half in 10 years by getting people to eat only a little bit better. Which brings me to point four. Point four is the previous 3 points were all about things you can do in the public sector, talking to your friends, working on your congressman or your local representative, whatever. Point four is our own diets. And I mentioned my diet of VB6, and I said it is just one way of eating better. The point is that everybody knows that eating more plants at the expense of eating less hyper-processed food, junk, soda, industrially raised animal products is the way to improve your health. And everybody thinks that it's very difficult to do that because the answer is to become a vegan. But no one, or I won't say no one, Gillian, in fact, is a vegan. Very few people become vegans. My point is this. There is a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum is someone who eats only plant foods, unprocessed foods, really healthy foods, and is fanatic about it. On the other end of the spectrum is Morgan Spurlock and the Supersize Me diet. Everybody in this room falls on the spectrum and probably not at the extremes. But the point is this. No matter what you do in your life, if you move your diet from wherever it is on the spectrum toward this end of the spectrum, the unprocessed foods, plants end of the spectrum, you will improve your diet and you will improve your health. And if you change one meal a day, in theory, if you have 21 meals a week, that's a third of your diet that changes. And that is a significant change. 2 meals a day, you've changed 2 meals of your diet. So rice and beans instead of cheeseburgers, salads instead of chicken McNuggets, oatmeal instead of bacon and eggs, so on down the line. Little tiny changes can make huge changes in your diet. It's not a black and white situation. It's, in fact, incremental and a spectrum. And as people eat better, they feel better, they weigh less, their blood sugar numbers go down, their cholesterol goes down, blah, 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 blah. All of that stuff is true. So, 4 points. What's food? Transparency, that is, how's it produced? Regulation, that is, let's get some government help in getting us to eat better. And our own personal, call it a food policy. How do we eat? Those are the things that we can all do. I think I'll take questions. I was going to say, I sometimes have to say this, but you've saved me the trouble, but I was going to say the person who raises their hand first always gets their question asked. The person who raises their hand last, it happens when I'm saying we're out of time. So, mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you for your speech, your lecture. Appreciate it. My name is Brandon. We live in Norwalk. Recently, I was diagnosed with an anti-inflammatory disease in my joints, and the doctor has been browbeating me about going gluten-free, red meat-free, and I'm not one of those people. but when it comes to that, I have looked at we've switched to whole wheat pasta, but I've gone to look for gluten-free. I go to Whole Foods for something like that. A box of gluten-free pasta is about $6.75. That is not really affordable for the average American who may have the same kind of health problem I and many others have. How are we going to tell people to go out and buy organic foods, gluten-free products, that sort of thing, when they really are not affordable for the average American?
Well, I'm sorry, actually, that you have that problem. I mean, seriously. I didn't say I was going to worry about it, but I'm sorry. I mean, one never likes to hear about... Anyway, that gluten-free is a specific problem. There's a very interesting question here, which is the question of why, when I was a kid, no one ever heard of gluten-free, and why, when I was a kid, there wasn't a single kid in the world who was allergic to peanuts, and now something like 6% of the population is allergic to peanuts. Why is this happening? That's a very interesting question. I don't know the answer. I just said it was an interesting question. If you have a health issue, the prevention is always less expensive than the cure, whether you're a poor person or a rich person. I think that's pretty much true. So you don't have to go to Whole Foods to buy gluten-free products. You can just devise a gluten-free diet. And if you want to find gluten-free pasta, that is going to be an expensive proposition. But if you're willing, if you need to give up gluten, a poor person can do that too. But I want to say one thing. I didn't say eat organic. I didn't say eat local, although both of those things are nice options, of course. I didn't say don't eat any meat. I didn't even say don't drink any soda. I certainly didn't say shop at Whole Foods. What I said was change the proportion of foods in your diet from hyperprocessed foods and industrially produced meat towards plants. And I stand by that. And that's something that can be done by everybody regardless of income, because junk food is actually not cheaper than real food. Real food winds up being cheaper than junk food. It's a question of understanding this, making a decision, and it also involves cooking. So it involves some work, but it involves what are your priorities? Do you want to live a healthy life or not? So, where's our friend with the mic? I think it would help if you noticed the next person who has their hand up.
Corinne Fine. I'd like to address the question that gentleman had about gluten-free products. I have members of my family who require gluten-free products, and you do not have to go to Whole Foods or Edge of the Woods exclusively. Job Lot carries the same brands, Bob's Red Mill and others, and the prices are fair and the dates are acceptable. So I recommend you try the Job Lots, and you do not have to compromise on quality, but you will get a good price.
Job Lot.
What did you think of Mayor Bloomberg's ban, his attempt to reduce?
Well, Mayor Bloomberg, an autocratic billionaire, has done some really great stuff in New York, including building more bike lanes in the last 4 years than were built in the whole history of the city, including banning trans fats from restaurants in New York, which was a great move, including mandating fast food restaurants put calorie counts on their products, which is going to be part of the national health care bill starting next year. These are all incredibly forward-thinking moves. He couldn't... we want checks and balances. He couldn't do everything, and we're thankful that he couldn't do everything, because whoever follows him up could then do everything in a different direction. He tried to get soda taxes passed, and they were shot down in Albany. He and his quite wonderful health commissioner, Tom Farley, came up with this plan to ban sodas larger than 16 ounces, and the courts shot it down. Doesn't matter that much. It would have been an interesting experiment, not as good an experiment as a soda tax, but an interesting experiment. And Cambridge and other cities are considering doing this, and it's going to happen eventually, as will a soda tax happen eventually. The point is, everybody knows about this stuff, too. Now the conversation has been expanded. Every time a city raises the prospect of a soda tax or a big gulp ban or any other regulation of soda or any other junk food. Inglewood, California, a few years ago, banned fast food chains from building anymore in their city. Anytime this stuff happens, it expands the conversation, it expands the number of people who know about this and think about it, and it makes it sound less kooky. Because when people started talking about soda tax 5 years ago, it's very kooky. And now it doesn't get laughed at so much anymore. So, that's what I think about that.
Hi, my name is Vanessa. I have a blog called My Kids Really Eat This. And I try to educate parents on getting their kids to eat well in the real world. And I work with our schools in trying to get healthy foods in the schools. And I find that a lot of the problems stem with people not cooking. They don't cook at home, or they cook processed foods and they don't give the kids the benefit of the doubt that they will actually eat. good food and instead will only eat things like chicken nuggets and macaroni and cheese. But when you go into the schools, they don't actually have the equipment to cook. And when you talk to people who say, well, the parents should be the ones to make the decisions, they too aren't actually cooking. And what do you think we can do to help those situations?
There's nothing you said that I disagree with. Kids are obviously, as older people with, I'll make this sound less harsh, as we older people with ingrained habits change our habits or die, children are going to become obviously the people who set the standards for what diets, what a so-called normal diet is. And kids are, in fact, pretty flexible, but it's true you have to give them the opportunity to eat decent food. School food is changing slowly but surely. It's being mandated. I mean, this is an example of regulation. It's being mandated by the Department of Agriculture that it changes. It's also being, that change is also being brought about by activist parents in schools all over the country. And these are great trends. It's true that the efforts of improving school food should be in lockstep with efforts of parents improving food in their own homes, but that's a much more difficult thing to mandate. I think what will happen is that children will eat better in schools. Some parents will raise their kids to boo when they go when they drive past a McDonald's, which is a phenomenon we've all seen at least a little bit. And then the question remains, what's going to happen with home cooking? And that is a question I can't answer. I spent 30-plus years as an advocate of home cooking. I have written an online piece called Cooking Solves Everything, which is sort of something that I believe, a bit of a hyperbolic title, but nevertheless, cooking solves a lot of problems, but you can't force people to cook. And the food is out there, the knowledge is out there. It's a question of prioritizing. And again, I think it's, if we had more transparency, if we had better regulations, we might get people to cook more. But that is an ongoing and big problem that we're working on.
Hi, my name is Bill Papiermeister, and I will be straightforward and honest with you. I thought I was coming here for a nitty-gritty on cooking and ways to cook, and I found a nice spiel on politically correctness, and I am the epitome of the anti-politically correctness. I think the only thing left was for you to establish or regulate the times in which we should eat and maybe a national diet. We should have maybe everybody should have the same thing at the same time every day. I believe that the problem basically goes through education, which is in shambles, and I believe in people making their own choices. And I believe that there are people that make good choices, some people don't make good choices, not only in regarding to food, but in regarding of many aspects of their lives. That's what I honestly believe. And regarding the people not buying genetically modified food in Europe, I go to Europe. My wife is German, and we spend a lot of time in Europe, and that is simply not true. There are people that don't eat it, and there are people that eat it. And it's in the markets. As you said, if you buy corn, you buy modified. If you buy soybean products, you buy modified. And I don't think it's bad, because a lot of people is fed in this world because of the modified, genetically modified.
Sorry, did you have a question?
No.
Okay, well, thank you. I agree that education is key. I do agree with that, and I'm sorry if you're disappointed.
Hi, I'm Jocelyn Spencer. I'm a 21-year-old college student, and I think one of the problems I've definitely seen, especially with my age group and younger, is people don't learn to cook. I met kids in college who didn't know how to boil water. And do you think that, you know, schools should have that as something you just learn, that even if you use school cafeteria or something like that, just kind of put that education there so the next generation can have that life skill and know how to cook for themselves in a healthy way and not be like some of my friends who live off lean cuisines?
It's a yes or no question. The answer is yes. I can expound on that a little bit. I think I actually am sort of encouraged by the behavior of many millennials, although it's hard to know who cooks and who cooks how much. The statistics say that we get 50%, that we eat 50% of our meals out of the home. But the 50% of the meals that we eat in the home, probably 80 or 90% of them are based on prepared foods. And if you microwave a pizza in the oven and eat it with a bag of chips, a Coke, and a chocolate layer cake that you bought at Stop and Shop, that counts as a meal cooked at home. So I think that maybe 10% of all meals are cooked at home, really cooked from scratch at home. It could be lower than that. And it's not going to go to 90% tomorrow. We know that. So the fact that you're asking that question, I hope you berate your friends who don't know how to boil water. I hope you teach them how to cook. And I do think things will change gradually. You know, one of the things when I was a kid, and almost everyone here who's my age will have had the same experience. When I was a kid, my mom, who was not a great cook, was a dutiful cook, cooked out of obligation, cooked every single night. And we ate home 6 nights a week. And when I was a little kid, and our eating out once a week, I think, was actually unusual at the time. When I was a little kid, my sister and I came home from school for lunch every day. So my mother, probably until I was, say, 11 or 12, probably cooked 15, maybe even 20 meals a week. And I grew up in that atmosphere. Someone who grew up in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s may have grown up in a home where their mom cooked 0 meals a week. That just did not happen in the 50s and 60s. This is a trend that can be explained, it can be analyzed to death, etc. The answer, of course, is not to make women stay home and cook. The answer is to teach everybody how to cook and expect grown-ups to be able to do some cooking for themselves, at least half of us, whether men or women, obviously. That's not a change that's going to happen anytime soon. And you did ask if we should reintroduce cooking into schools, and obviously, yes. And when I was in junior high school, the girls had home ec, and we had shop. And I will tell you that my friend Kenny Heisler, who lives up in Falmouth, still has his cute little tin bank that he made in shop. So did us some good anyway.
Hi, my name is Pat Powers, and I have a big family. And what I am hearing here is that the parents are not letting the kids be educated. I taught as a volunteer in Weston Middle School classes in cooking, and I had to keep coming up with more and more things. Do you know, I meet mothers today that say, I still make that chicken cordon bleu and that chocolate mousse. So a lot of it goes back to the parents and us supporting the schools and the government in education.
Okay, thank you. I think maybe if you don't have a question, but you want to make a statement, let the people who have questions ask their questions.
Hi. Big fan of yours.
Thank you.
I was very upset when you left The Minimalist, but I'm so excited.
I killed The Minimalist. He's dead.
Yeah, I love that, but I love what you're doing now.
Thank you.
So there's another non-question. The other thing is that growing up in Connecticut, I'll just say the 60s, there was a soda tax and a candy tax, and the idea was that you taxed things that were non-food. I don't know when that disappeared, but in my household, that meant there was never any soda growing up, so I never developed a taste for it. My other question to you, though, is I find for myself stress eating, convenience food, junk food, they all kind of go together. And I wonder if you have something you could say about the intersect of that phenomenon with poverty and stressful lives and working 2 jobs.
Well, you don't have to be poor to be busy. You probably do have to be poor to take the bus an hour each way to work and to work 2 jobs. Poor or desperate. the busier you are, obviously the more stress you're under. And the food is there. There's no question that I don't think fast food is cheap, but there's certainly no denying that it's convenient. And all people can do is recognize that, recognize that it's probably not good for them, and look for alternatives. And you don't beat yourself up when you fall off the wagon, or whatever you want to call it, when you're exercising your own personal food policy. You just get back on and you do the best you can. I think also we're going to see increasing numbers of fast food restaurants that serve relatively healthy, relatively real food, and that's going to help matters some.
I wonder if I could ask a personal question, please.
I might not have to answer it, but...
What did you eat yesterday? Where did it come from? Did you cook?
I'm happy to answer that question, but I have to think. I went to New Jersey to tape television. I left the house at 6:30. Before I left the house, I can't tell you not to laugh, but I had the kind of breakfast that I sometimes have and really enjoy, which was black chickpeas that I had cooked previously, brown rice that I had cooked previously, and broccoli rabe mixed together and microwaved until hot. It wasn't my favorite thing ever, but it was okay. And I was full. Lunch was a sandwich from a nearby deli, and it was hummus and grilled vegetables, and it was sort of okay, except everything fell out of the sandwich as soon as I took a bite. And then I got home really late, 8 o'clock, and had pasta with a little bit of bacon, tomato sauce, onion, Parmesan. Not a terrible day. It's easier when you don't travel, I find.
Good morning. I wanted to ask what you would recommend in terms of advocacy groups that address the kind of issues that you were talking about, the cruelty to animals, the chemicals, and the working conditions. Could you suggest one or two groups, or do you have that information available?
No, I think
on your website? And I have one other question.
Go ahead.
Butter or margarine?
Oh, well, margarine is death. Don't eat margarine. There is this sort of new stuff called, maybe it's called healthy, I don't know what it's called. It's made, but if you take olive oil and put it in the refrigerator, it'll congeal and you can pretend that's margarine. But trans fats are death. So if it's margarine with trans fats, that's really bad. The first question is, I do like, I think the Humane Society of the United States, HSUS, is doing great work in animal welfare. I never would have said this 5 years ago. I think even PETA is doing really good work. They've become, forgive me for saying this, more moderate, and we're kind of allied on some issues, even though I don't really believe in animal rights. I believe in animal welfare. There's a distinction there. But those two groups are good. I also, since the questions come up, you didn't ask this particular thing, but I do think that every parent who has a kid in a public school, well, in a school system, should be looking at what that kid is being served in that school, asking whether they themselves would be eating that food, and then storming into the principal's office or to the Board of Ed's office or whatever and discussing that. Because everywhere in this country, parents, and New Haven is included in this, of course, parents have made a difference in what their kids are eating in schools, and that's really, really key. And by being involved, of course, parents are then more aware of what their kids are eating. They change what they're cooking at home or serving at home and so on. But I think for parents, the school food thing is just huge. It's the issue. I think we're going to take two more questions, and then because we want some time for signing books. So lucky you.
I have a slightly personal and very serious question. Sally's or Pepe's?
I have not. Such a New Haven question. And, you know, you meet people all over. I travel a lot. You meet people all over the country who will say to you that same question. I often say modern, just to be... just to be difficult. But I will say this: New Haven, I haven't been to any of them in a few years. I did like Pepe's more, in part because they were meaner, and it was kind of fun that they were so mean. But I don't know what's happened at Pepe's since the grand expansion to Fairfield and beyond. So I wonder about that. I will say it is amazing that the pizza here really is better than it is anywhere else. It's unbelievable. Well, so what? But last question.
Is this on?
Okay. Make it a good one.
My name is Tanya, and my question is around additives, and I've been really trying to avoid things that have long lists of ingredients and trying to cut back. And the one thing that I notice is ubiquitous is artificial and natural flavoring. And I'm wondering if you have an opinion on that. I mean,
I have an opinion on it.
Well, I take issue with even natural flavoring because I feel like even that has been engineered and plays with our minds and our eating. And
here's the thing. I'll cut you short because I know what I'm going to say, not because I'm not sorry if I'm rude. Michael Pollan's famous edict, don't eat anything with more than 5 ingredients on the label, not bad. Michael Pollan's other famous edict, don't eat anything that your grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. For some of you, it's your great-grandmother, but you get the message. The active ingredient in broccoli is broccoli. You want to be, if you are taking individual ingredients that you're buying in the store and putting them together by yourself and applying heat, that's called cooking. Actually, even if you're not applying heat, it's called cooking. And that's the best way to eat. I totally agree with you. Natural ingredients are just as mysterious as artificial ingredients. We don't know what's going on. Hold on to your hats. There are 5,000 additives generally recognized as safe by the FDA, and the FDA probably only knows about half of them. Manufacturers are allowed to so-called test and assure us that additives are safe without even running them by the FDA. And if this isn't a good reason for eating foods that have single solitary ingredients that you know what they are, I don't know what else is. This is the kind of stuff that has to change. I could add reform the FDA, reform the USDA to my list of three or four things that we all ought to be doing, but that stuff is so far down the road, it's unimaginable. That falls into the eat what you think is, eat for yourself, eat what you think is right. Do some cooking, combine so-called natural ingredients, real ingredients, and do it for yourself as well as everybody else. Okay, I guess we're going to...
That's it.
We're going to sign books. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for supporting WSHU.